When your name is a rhyme, that makes it easy for people to remember you. And when you're the person who King Kong got a crush on in the 1933 movie, that can make you a household name, too. By now, you may have figured out we'll be talking about Faye Ray in this hour. And we'll talk about her second husband. Robert Riskin was a star at the typewriter in Golden Age Hollywood, writing notable scripts like Meet John Doe and It Happened One Night, films that won Oscars. Their life together is the focus of the book called Faye Ray and Robert Riskin, a Hollywood memoir. Victoria Riskin is their daughter and the author of the book. Victoria very much followed in her father's footsteps with a career in writing and producing that won her several awards. She adapted Willa Cather's My Antonia for TV and produced Carson Cullers, the member of The Wedding. Victoria Riskin, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
It's lovely to be with you, and I hear the weather report, and it sounds... I wanted to get in the car and come up to that beautiful part of the country where you all are.
Come visit. We'll do it again in the studio sometime.
Okay.
So your mom put out her autobiography years ago. What more did you want to tell here in this memoir?
Well, her autobiography was extremely helpful to me in tracking her life and her point of view about her life. But a huge piece was missing, a lot of detail and color, but I wanted to reconstruct both of their lives, my father's life and my mother's life, and I wanted to go into more detail where her life was concerned and see her movies and read the reviews and read more family letters and things that she just didn't have room for or time for, and then put my own reflections on that story. And as part of my journey, I found my father, who I lost when I was a child. He had a stroke and died when I was young, and I almost couldn't think about it because it made me sad to think about him for many years. I really missed him. And then when I discovered him, I found the details of his remarkable life and old Hollywood and the labor wars and the depression and a much big tapestry that my mother was not able to touch in her autobiography. This is a different book.
Well, and you know, they are both very accomplished people, as we mentioned mm-hmm. at the outset here. Your father's credit list is nothing short of amazing. It Happened One Night, Lost Horizon, and Meet John Doe, just for starters. And so where did he get his beginnings as a writer?
Well, it depends how far you go back to trace his beginnings, but when he was a 16-year-old kid, he got a job working in the garment industry, and his boss was illiterate and had fallen in love with a vaudeville star named Trixie Fraganza. You can't make names like that.
You really can't.
and so he asked my father to write her love notes. So like Cyrano de Bergerac, he wrote Trixie Fraganza love notes for his boss. And he loved writing. He had already been writing little short stories and poems. However, Trixie did not return the interest in my father's boss, so my father was fired and had to find a new job. But he then went to work for another team of men in the garment business, and they were investing in short comedies that were being made in Florida, and they were not very good. And my father told them, you know, those movies aren't very good. And they said, you go down there and write and produce and direct them. And he did. He was 17.
Wow.
So he was catapulted quite young into writing and producing these wonderful little comedies. He ended up making over 100 comedies in a two-year period.
He was almost like a modern day TV producer in that sense.
He was, in fact, it was very much like modern day TV writer producers, where you do everything and you set the entire course for the films. And I think he learned so much about filmmaking and storytelling and writing, and it was a great a learning period for him. And then he would have continued, but it was a time when they were starting to conscript people into World War One, and he knew he better sign up before they sent him off as a foot soldier. So he joined the Navy, and as a low-level officer, but at least it got him out of having to go overseas, and mm-hmm. they stationed him in New York. And then that became the bridge for him to start writing and producing on Broadway.
We'll come back and talk a little more about Robert Riskin's background. Obviously, we have a lot of time to talk about that with Victoria Riskin here. But it sounds like with all the people your parents, Robert Riskin and Fay Wray, knew, there were some really interesting people at parties at your house.
It was such a natural thing, and I didn't really reflect on it till I did this book to reflect that Cary Grant or William Powell or Ronald Coleman or Rosalind Russell, all these people who were lionized by the rest of the country, just we all hung out together, and there were dinner parties and square dances. Everybody loved square dancing in the late 1940s, and there were Easter egg hunts, and everything had a kind of a bigness, at least from my point of view as a child. It was a magical time, and people loved to have fun. So much has been written about old Hollywood from a slightly scandalous point of view, which I take exception to, which doesn't mean there weren't scandalous activities. But in fact, it was a small town full of people of imagination and creativity and strong families. There were many people who had happy marriages, like my parents. And the kids had a great time. Lots of, fireworks at 4th of July and magicians coming for kids' parties. It was a lot of fun.
Victoria Riskin's book about her parents' life together is called Fay Wray and Robert Riskin, A Hollywood Memoir. We'll come back and talk more with Victoria. And if you'd like to join us as we talk about Fay and Robert, you can join us by phone and email when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about Fay Wray and Robert Riskin. In a memoir by that name by their daughter, Victoria Riskin. Fay Wray's name you probably know, King Kong's Love in the 1933 movie, but a lot of other movies to her credit. Robert Riskin, a rather unsung, it would seem, screenwriter. Any one of these scripts would have been enough for a career. Lost Horizon, Meet John Doe, It Happened One Night. He wrote all three of them, and he's Victoria Riskin's father, Fay Wray, her mother. You can join the conversation on the exchange as we talk about their life, as reflected by Victoria. 800-838-3700. 760 by phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Victoria, you were just talking about the bigness. You know, there were some big events that went on at your house growing up because your parents mm-hmm. were very well connected in Hollywood. And yet, mm-hmm. From the first pages of the book, it still sounds like, outside of the events, a fairly sedate and tranquil home life.
Well, my parents had a wonderful relationship, very warm and loving, and they focused on themselves, their relationship, but also their children, and wanted to create a kind of safety and sense of imagination and comfort and security. So in that way, there were no crises, there were no scandals. It was really a wonderful childhood. And I think that was true for others in their circle. They had a very good circle of close, close friends, and their children, too, lived a kind of lovely life. And with people, you know, it was wonderful growing up with people who had great imagination and a sense of playfulness and an intellectual acumen that was exciting. So that was my world and the world of our friends.
So you mentioned that your father died relatively young, had a stroke, and then lasted mm-hmm. just a few years beyond that. How old was mm-hmm. he when he had the? How old were you when he had the stroke?
Well, I was had my sixth birthday, and he came home one day, having a terrible headache, and they, within a few days, he was in the hospital having brain surgery. They thought he had a brain tumor, but in fact, he'd had a terrible stroke. And in those days, they didn't have anticoagulants or the kind of vascular surgery they do today. So he was partially paralyzed and had mental, struggles. And then my mother cared for him at home for a while, but then he went to a convalescent home and died when I was 10. And as a little girl, I just couldn't quite accept that that was happening. So I actually share with your listeners, I imagined that he had gone on a trip to the south of France and that I would find him when I was older. Because even though I visited him in the convalescent home, it was just a story that I used to tell myself at night so I wouldn't have to deal with kind of the truth.
Yeah, which was a lot grimmer than your father being in the south of France, certainly.
Right, and he was such a magical person that it seemed so unfair. Actually, George Jessel, who was a famous comedian at the time, was a speaker at his funeral, and he said if you were to write Robert Riskin's story as a play, the first two acts would be written with a note of joy and the last with a tear, and the last act with a tear. And in some ways, I always thought, well, that did capture how it was a before and after, this magical life and then this tragedy. But my mother, I also recognized in writing the book, and people think of her as a beautiful movie star and life must have been perfect, but in fact, she had to call upon her inner strength and her resilience and her generally optimistic spirit to look after three children and take care of an ill husband and go back to work. So as I read, you know, as a child, you just think, well, I just want my needs met. You know, I need to get to school or go spend the weekend with a friend or whatever. She managed all of that, but I realized how incredibly strong and resilient she was. Even though there were times I knew it was extremely hard for her, I could see that as a child.
You know, I hesitate to say that somebody's on-screen, off-screen strength is going to be portrayed on the screen, but I do want the people to know, if they only think of your mother as screaming in King Kong, that she had many, many roles. And I wanted to play a clip here. This is from 1939's Navy Secrets with Grant Withers, and see who sounds strong here.
You mind if I make a suggestion?
What?
If I were you, I'd disappear for a while where nobody could find me.
Thanks. And listen, sailor boy, let me suggest something. In the future, be more careful about the friends you pick. Good night.
Night.
There wasn't enough dialogue to play the other clip. I love the fact that Fay Wray is actually the one who saves Grant Withers. She's the one who unties him when he's caught by the bad guys.
She played she had over 120 starring roles in her career. And she played a spy, and she played a bimbo, and she played a countess, and a this and a that. You know, she played everything. And I think if people only remember her, and she's wonderful in King Kong. I'm not minimizing that role, but there were so many others, and she was just wonderful. In 1 2-year period, 1933 to 1934. She starred in 21 films in a 2-year period, almost a movie a month. And I hadn't seen hardly any of these films, which was kind of amazing for me to find as many as I could for the book. And I would go down to Sony Pictures, and they had some in the archives, and I'd sit all by myself in a big screening room, and they'd play them for me. And I just could see why the audiences of the 1930s loved her. She was always wonderful to look at and had a kind of style and a punch and spark, and it was great.
Yeah, she just, on screen, she looked realized, you know. She just had her stuff together in a lot of ways,
right.
if you look at it that way. So let's talk about your mom's family. This is a very tough pioneer stock from Utah, from the sounds of it.
Right. So she... she was born in Canada, but then the family moved from Canada because it was just too difficult and too cold, and they settled back where her mother and father had been from, which was in Utah. And her father found a job in a mining town in called a town called Lark, Utah. It was a copper mining town, and he was given a job as a night foreman. It was tough. It was dirty. It was difficult. And that's where she spent her years, maybe 5 to 10 years of age. And it had a huge impact on her because it was, those were seminal years. Her mother had been college educated, and to find herself and her children in this dusty, dirty mining town was almost humiliating for her. And so she very much had an iron oversight, an iron hand in her oversight of her children, and made sure they were always properly dressed and clean and their hair curled and their hands creamed, you know, and taught them manners. And but life was very difficult. And then ultimately her father left. I think it was just too hard for him, and his wife was overbearing and angry much of the time. He disappears, and so the family moved to Salt Lake, where there were other family members, and now they really had a hard time because there was no money coming in, and the kids all had to find little jobs just to keep them going. So, and then 1918 flu epidemic comes and hits the entire family, and my mother's older sister, who she adored, dies, and it's a very shaky time for them. My mother said there were times they didn't have enough to eat. They ate something they called bread soup, a little piece of bread and a little bit of milk. And their stomachs were growly a lot of the time. But they persevered. I think my mother and the other kids, too, wondered, what can we do to help? And my mother sold newspapers. She joined a kind of a newspaper selling contest where you sell subscriptions. And since she won that little contest, and the prize was you got to be in a movie. Well, it wasn't really a movie. It was just a guy with a camera who took a little picture of her sitting on a bench holding some roses and smelling them and looking up at the sky like they were the best smelling roses ever. And then that flashed on a screen in a local movie house, and it catapulted her thinking into the movies, because for kids, and it's probably true today too, going to the movies is a way to escape and be in an imaginary world. And she'd first seen movies in this little mining town when she watched the silent movies of Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks and Lillian Gish and the old, you know, those wonderful old-time silent movies. And I think she began to imagine, maybe I could be in the movies.
All right, let's pick up the story in just a moment here with Victoria Riskin. After I remind you listening that we're talking to Victoria Riskin about her parents, Fay Ray and Robert Riskin. That is the title of her book about them, a Hollywood memoir. And you can join the conversation on The Exchange as we talk about Fay Ray and her long career in acting, and Robert Riskin, who didn't have as long a career, but a very notable career in screenwriting with some great things that came out of his typewriter, including It Happened One Night. You can join the conversation on The Exchange at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So your mother's hardscrabble life, mostly in Utah, we were just talking about. Let's talk about your father's background, very different kind of thing.
Well, he was born first-generation Jewish. His parents came from Belarus, getting away from the pogroms and the Cossacks' assaults on the Jewish communities, and they came to New York in the late 1800s. And he was born just before the turn of the century on the Lower East Side. They lived over a liquor store. They were very poor as well, but so excited to be in America. And so the whole household, as my father grew up, loved America. It was the place of safety and imagination and opportunity. And when things got a little bit better financially, ultimately ended up in Brooklyn. And there was a very vibrant vaudeville scene going on in the neighborhood. So my father, instead of going to synagogue on Friday nights or staying in school, he would sneak away and go into these vaudeville houses. And there were wonderful comedians, who many of whom we know, who came out of vaudeville, and he would write down the jokes. He started writing as soon as he could probably hold a pencil. And he learned shorthand, taught himself shorthand, so he could write them down as fast as possible. Later, he said he was still using those jokes in a more sophisticated way in his films, just putting more polish on them. But it was a very close-knit family. His parents were funny and warm, and he said his father never had a steady job, but he was a tailor, so he would pick up jobs here and there. And as soon as my father was 13, he quit school, and he and his brother sold newspapers on trolley cars. So it was, but they had a great time. It was a family that was very close, and a lot of warmth and laughter, and also a sense of humanity. I think my grandfather was very influenced by what people call the Enlightenment era of modern thinking. That was that we all should look after one another and help each other, in a sense of responsibility to community and to country. And those ideas that were planted in that household carried through all of my father's films, whether it was Lady for a Day or, as you mentioned, Meet John Doe, Mr. Deeds Goes to Town. So the humor and the sense of humanity were baked in from his childhood.
Interesting relationship he had with Frank Capra in his career, particularly on movies like Meet John Doe. And it sounds like they had a pretty good balance of enthusiasms for and against the country that they managed to get to a good working relationship with.
Yes, it's actually kind of a remarkable a working relationship, as I now sort of look at it, because Frank Capra was not the humanist or the advocate for the common man by nature. He had been an Italian immigrant and actually didn't speak English till he was maybe 7 or 8, and was ridiculed as a child, and he really fought his way up the chain to be successful, and sort of felt that people like Franklin Roosevelt, who and the New Deal wanted to take his money away from him. But he was a very gifted director. He had gone to Caltech, an engineering school. He had good instincts about timing and movement and so on. But he hadn't had really good screenplays to work with. And when my father came along, he loved my father, and my father loved him. I mean, whatever the political differences were, and they sometimes fought out issues, they really loved each other. And my father saw in Frank a guy who could take the camera and bring his stories to life, work well with the actors, give style and movement to the pictures. And Frank saw in my father a man who had something wonderful to say that the audiences in America responded to immediately, and a great ear for dialogue and storytelling. So it was they were wonderful sides of the same, you know, different sides of the same coin, but kind of a perfect blending.
Yeah, we jumped ahead to Hollywood here at my instigation, but he really got there through Broadway. So, I mean, he'd done the movie work you mentioned in Florida when he was a producer at age 17, joined the Navy for World War I. He was broke and unemployed soon after. How did he get his career restarted then?
Yeah, on Broadway?
Yeah.
Well, he started making little films, little comedies in New York, and they weren't going so well. But Broadway was exploding. It was blossoming. In my research, I learned that there were maybe 250 theaters in Manhattan alone. And so on almost every corner, there was a theater. And so they decided he and his brother would become Broadway producers. And they found some plays that had been done in England but not in the United States. And they went around, you know, gathering up people who had put a little money into these plays, and they were successful producing. I found all the old reviews of their producing projects. And af- after a couple of years, then my father wanted to write. So he began writing as well as producing. And that continued up till 1929, when the stock market crash just wiped out everything. The theaters, the newspapers, and so on. He was also living with a woman at that time who was a writer, and they wrote plays together.
That was Edith Fitzgerald. And
Edith Fitzgerald, who I knew nothing about. I mean, here's my father's first love relationship and girlfriend, and I had to do a lot of digging to find out about her.
We'll come back and talk about the process of researching your parents. The book, again, is called Fay Wray and Robert Riskin, A Hollywood Memoir. Victoria Riskin, their daughter, is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, talking about her parents who were married until her father's death in 1955 from a stroke, complications of a stroke. You can join the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about old golden age Hollywood and how these people got along in it. Sounds like they did relatively well. And we'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Victoria Riskin and you in a minute 20. Segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Victoria Riskin, who grew up the daughter of relatively famous parents, Fay Wray and Robert Riskin, her parents, and the title of Victoria's book, subtitled A Hollywood Memoir. Fay Wray, you probably know from King Kong and about 120 other movies. Robert Riskin, perhaps not as well known, but certainly deserving of a lot of credit for some of the great screenplays he wrote, including Platinum Blonde, American Madness, It Happened One Night, Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, Lost Horizon, Meet John Doe, and on and on. You can join our conversation about Victoria's famous parents on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking about Edith Fitzgerald, with whom your father lived in Queens back in New York City when his career was just getting off the ground. But this is a big deal. They were cohabiting in the 1920s?
It was very avant-garde, to say the least. My father inherited kind of this point of view from his father, which was an interesting one, and that was that when two people really loved each other, sometimes marriage changes that sense of love and romance. And I guess Edith accepted that philosophy too, and they lived together and enjoyed each other and worked together, wrote plays together. But we're not married. And in some of the newspaper clippings I found, they were described as married because, you know, that's the way people wanted to find them. But they never married. I think also they had a lovely relationship, but I don't think my father saw himself marrying Edith. But he also stayed away from marriage with the other women in his life when he came to Hollywood.
So I chuckled because it seems like a play about a cohabiting couple was an instrument in getting him his Hollywood break. The
That's screen... right. It was a kind of autobiographical piece.
Illicit was the name of the work.
Illicit with Barbara Stanwyck. It was a cute story about how. Well, first of all, when the crash came, he had a lovely bank account before the crash, and you know it was stock market investments and all that. He was doing very well, and then there was zero in the bank account. I mean, almost nothing. And he had tried to get some work in Hollywood, and no one answered the telegrams he sent, and then someone asked him to come, and said that Warner Brothers wanted to buy this story he had written, and he somehow sensed they really wanted it, and he really played it. It's a charming story about how he negotiated for the sale, because the guy said, well, I'll give you $5,000 for this, which is more money than he could have ever imagined. I mean, that would have been like, I don't know, how much today, you know, $100,000, and he said, no, I don't, $5,000 won't do it, I want $50,000. And here he had no money, and we went back and forth, and finally what happened was, the upshot was that they were already in production, and they had to have the rights because they were in the middle of filming it. And it's a very racy little movie. It's a wonderful little movie, and Barbara Stanwyck, no matter what she's in, is wonderful, but they were already making it. But he got such a lucrative, he ended up selling to the guy for $30,000.
Wow.
And he was rich overnight, I mean really rich overnight, and then was offered a contract at Columbia for another play he had written called Miracle Woman. Also, it starred Barbara Stanwyck. And he came out to Columbia Pictures under contract. But there again, he sort of gambled, and he called around to see what other writers were earning under contract at Columbia, and he asked for twice as much, and they gave it to him. So overnight, he was a very wealthy man.
Wow. So, all right, so that establishes how your father, Robert Riskin, got to Hollywood. We talked about your mother's interest in movies developing in Utah, where she lived. Now, the circumstances of your mother's departure from Utah for a girl of her age were unusual for the time, to say the least.
It was the most improbable story. So my mother's sister had a friend, maybe slightly a boyfriend, I don't know, but a friend who was a 21-year-old young man who was a photographer, William Mortensen. And when her sister was brought him home, everybody loved this young man. He was very well educated. He was a fine photographer in the fine arts sense of it. And at some point he said to my grandmother, I think I'm going to go to Hollywood to get work, and I think Faye could get work in the movies. She'd won that little contest I described earlier. And so her grandmother said, all right, well, why don't you take Faye to Hollywood? And so William Mortensen and my mother, 14 years old, she gets on the train with him, and they head for Los Angeles. They're somewhere over the Rockies. He turns to her, and he says, you are really a lovely young woman. And she says, thank you. And he says, and the truth is, it's not your sister I'm in love with. It's you that I love. And her heart just sank. You know, she's on the train by herself, and no way to turn back, and no telephone. And she said, I felt as old as a 14-year-old could feel in that moment. And in fact, generally, when he got her to Hollywood, he placed her in a family. He picked her up after school. He took her to see how movies were being made. He met people and finally helped her get a little part in a movie. And she was very attached to him, in truth. And he took wonderful photographs of her and gave her an education, because he'd had a very sophisticated arts education. So in some ways, her mother was quite a strong and domineering person, even though she let her go, I think, basically because they were so poor. And my mother said, I think maybe there was one less mouth to feed. And so her mother was all right with it at first, and then changed her mind and came and yanked my mother away from this Mortensen person. But he really he did love her. There's no question that he loved her. And at one point he did kind of cross the line a little bit, but mostly he looked after her. I think he was a little confused about whether he was an uncle, a big brother, or a romantic person in her life.
He seems to have certainly had a kind of a cloudy approach to things, but ultimately it worked out fine for her. So how old was she when she made her first film?
She was probably 16, or 15 and a half, six or so, you know, right. Well, maybe even younger, because she did a couple of little bit parts. But by the time she was 16 and her mother had come and pulled her away and established life for them together as a family in Los Angeles, my mother went to Hal Roach Studios and said, I've been in a couple of movies, and can you give me work here? She just went to the chief of production. She walked in the front gate, found his office, and he said, well, yes, I will. I'll give you a 6-month contract. So she did early comedies, and that supported the entire family.
Wow. See, 120 movies you say she made, and and you say in the book that The Wedding March is your favorite. Why?
The Wedding March, which was a silent film written and directed and starring Eric von Stroheim. People mostly remember him from Sunset Boulevard, but it was this beautiful, epic film, a story of a Prussian prince, Eric von Stroheim, whose family is losing money hand over fist, and he's supposed to marry the daughter of a rich businessman to sort of replenish the coffers of the royal household. But he falls in love with this young peasant girl whose father owns a beer hall, and she's being forced to marry a rather loathsome character who's a butcher. And they at a parade, the prince is part of a parade. He captures her eye, she captures his eye, and there's a kind of calamity where the horses are spooked, and she falls and breaks her leg, and he comes to see her in the hospital. And she's just beautiful in it, and yeah, she's really this is her first starring role. And she'd been doing little westerns, so this was such a step up for her. But he was a master filmmaker. There's a scene in the beer garden where he comes to see her and he romances her. And he had violins on the set. There were cherry blossom trees. He had 500 little cherry blossoms attached to these trees they built. He imported masses of costumes to have the real look of what Prussian aristocracy wore. But it's those little moments where he romances her and she's falling for him, very much falling for him. And it's a kind of a tragedy. It's a romantic tragedy. In the end, and she's just beautiful in the film. It plays now. I'm going to be doing a presentation at the Silent Film Festival in San Francisco, and one again also in El Paso, Texas, and in New York, and at the American Film Institute with this film as part of my book tour. And in each instance, there'll be a live pianist or an organist playing the music from the original film. And if you don't cry at the end of it, there's something wrong with you. I mean, it's just beautiful. It's just beautiful. I always sob. I sob early because I know how it ends.
Uh-huh, sure. All right, that's The Wedding March. Now, this is cool, though. Your mom starred in a movie with a script by your father, but didn't meet him in the process of making that film.
You know, it's as I think about their story, there are so many times when they almost met. This is one of them. He wrote a movie called Anne Carver's Profession about an attorney, a woman attorney. That was he was very much a feminist in his own way. He really loved women and had thought they were bright and smart, and often the way they're characterized in his films, they're spunky and independent. And so in Anne Carver's Profession, the woman is, she plays this attorney, and she's has some big cases, and her career is going like gangbusters, and her husband, who is an architect, is feeling left out and left behind, and she has less time to pay attention to him. And so it was a very modern idea. In the end, she realizes that she has been ignoring him, and she turns her attentions back to him. And so my mother plays this high-powered attorney. And it's kind of a fun movie. It did all right at the time, but she also starred the same year in King Kong, and that just wiped everything else off the map. I mean, that was so successful.
You know, when you go looking for clips of your mother, Faye Ray, on YouTube, mm-hmm. you find like 16 clips of screams from King Kong, including compilation reels of just the screams. Did it ever grate on her that was the movie she was best remembered for?
I think she had mixed feelings about it, having done so many films and with wonderful actors like Spencer Tracy or Claude Rains and interesting parts. But in the end, King Kong has become this classic film that she ended up appreciating it. She loved the guys who made the film, Marion C. Cooper and Ernst B. Schoedsack, who were the co-directors and creators of the film. So she always had a tender spot in her heart for them. And in the end, people today remember Fay Wray because of King Kong. And in her own autobiography, and I just put it in my book as well because I thought it was so charming, she wrote a letter to him saying, saying she assumed he was on Skull Island and in retirement. And she didn't exactly have the zip code for Skull Island, but she hoped the letter got to him. And she said, you know, we've been tied together for a long time, and I hope you're doing fine, and so on. And she found playful ways to talk about King Kong that I think everybody enjoyed.
Well, certainly an interesting life together for not terribly long, married from 1942 until Robert Riskin's death in 1955. The book is Fay Wray and Robert Riskin, a Hollywood memoir. Their daughter, Victoria Riskin, is the author and our guest. Victoria, good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
It's been lovely. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Take care.